in Colorado Springs, when the killer, the wannabe killer, is taken off his game, and he's the element of surprise is removed from him and transfers to the victims, then that changes his behavior very quickly. In the case in South Africa, one of them had been wounded, and they both fled. In fact, there were three accomplices, and they all fled.
Let me ask you this, Larry, because the question arises to me not about the security guards, who I personally have no problem with having a gun, but how these two young men both were mentally ill, both had threatened violence against others. One of them was, in fact, a ward of the state for 4 years. The other one was hearing voices. And, you know, this guy, you can't really blame liberal society. He was homeschooled by Christian fundamentalists. And yet he, although he wouldn't use obscenities, apparently he would still murder. So there are all kinds of crazy people in all walks of life. They had AK-47s. This is not a handgun. This is not, you know, a simple self-defense thing, I don't think, unless you think it is. These are machine guns, or proto-machine guns, semi-automatic machine guns. Do you think mentally ill people...
Well, there's no such thing as a semi-automatic machine gun.
Okay, a semi-automatic gun.
Semi-automatic
almost a machine gun.
People used to hunt with, so
an AK-47?
There's a pretty big distinction.
Do people hunt with AK-47s?
Some do, as a matter of fact. It's a better hunting gun than is the AR-15, which is the civilian equivalent of our military rifle. Well, the AK-47 is a somewhat more powerful round.
Let me just ask you,
deer with an AR-15, you may not kill it.
Well, let me just ask you this before we get to Brian. Should people like Robert Hawkins and Matthew Murray have had access to AK-47s? And if your answer is no, what existing laws do you support to prevent them from getting access to guns like that?
It's not a question of should. It's a question of will they? And, of course, unhappily, because they were criminals, they will. They will get guns even in a place like Washington, D.C. with a ban, even in a place like England, which is an island, with a ban. They get guns. The problem is, when are we going to wake up and realize that the victims need to be able to protect themselves against people who get guns no matter what? These laws that are designed to keep, quote, guns from getting into the wrong hands only keep guns from getting into the right hand.
So, Larry, you don't support any existing laws or increased regulations to prevent mentally ill people who have, you know, violent tendencies like these two men from getting guns like AK-47.
If somebody's been convicted in a court with due process, or there's been a court order where there's been due process, the right to confront the accuser and so forth, that's another matter. But we're not talking about that. We're just talking about suspicion. We're talking about a psychiatrist with his sole diagnosis being used as the basis for taking people's civil rights away.
Okay,
I
Larry,
think that's
these
totally
two men,
unacceptable in America.
One of them was awarded the state for 4 years because of his violent tendency. Now, a lot of these, I mean, these are young men. One was 19, I think the other was 24. One was incarcerated as a juvenile for his violent behavior. Is that good enough for you to say this man shouldn't be allowed to have a gun?
You can say he shouldn't be allowed to have the gun, but how are you going to enforce that short of a ban, which even in the case of a ban doesn't keep people like that from getting guns? So you keep coming back to the same unanswered question.
Oh, I just want to know if you support those laws.
You haven't found a tool that's effective. You haven't found a law that works, other than, like Washington or England, disarming the good guys.
Okay, but do you support or do you not support a law that when a kid has been in a ward of the state for 4 years due to his mentally ill, violent behavior, do you support a law that says at least he shouldn't be able to walk into a gun store or a gun show and just buy a gun? Do you support that law?
I'm not going to say yes to any law that only has impact on the good guys and doesn't affect guys like that. And we kid ourselves when we think that a law that we pass is going to prevent bad guys from doing something, getting a gun in this case, and then using it in a criminal fashion after that.
But you haven't answered my question. How does a law that prevents...
No, I have answered your question.
Wait, how does a law that says that if you're mentally ill and you've been awarded the state for 4 years, you shouldn't be able to own a gun, that limited law, I'm not talking about the D.C. handgun ban or England, we'll get to that, but how does a limited law that focuses on the mentally ill, why would you oppose that?
If it's an enhanced penalty for being found with the gun, that's one thing.
But you wouldn't oppose these people who hear voices and have
more
to the state.
I'm not going to set up a system that's only going to impact the good guys, because that just empowers the criminal, as it has in Washington, D.C., as it has in England, as it has in Chicago.
Somebody who's violent and mentally ill and a ward of the state and threatens to kill their stepmother and hears voices, that's a good guy in your view?
You're not going to keep them from getting guns. You can enhance their penalties. But we are kidding ourselves, just like when we set up gun-free zones at schools and churches and malls, and think that that's going to keep these kind of cretins from bringing guns in. Just doesn't happen.
Okay, let me switch to Brian here. Brian, I tried very hard to get Larry Pratt to say at least he would support a gun ban on those kinds of mentally ill people, and he wouldn't do that. First of all, you have a comment on that, and then I got some more questions for you.
Well, I mean, a couple comments I would make is, you know, for 10 years we had an assault weapon ban in this country, and it actually was very effective. During the time of the ban, crime came down basically every year. And from the beginning of the ban to the end of the ban, the rate at which assault weapons were recovered in crime across America declined by two-thirds, 66%. So to us, that's a very effective law. It actually reduced these kinds of mass shootings, because along with the ban on AK-47s and Uzis and other kinds of assault weapons, it banned high-capacity magazines. And the one common factor here, the shooter at Virginia Tech had 32-round clips, had more than 1,000 rounds carried on him. The guy in Colorado also was carrying 1,000 rounds. The guy in Omaha had 30-round clips with his assault rifle. These high-capacity magazines, anything more than 10 rounds, were banned also during that 10-year period. So that was a very effective law, and actually helped reduce these kinds of mass shootings. You know, it's interesting to note, I think, that law enforcement deaths by firearm this year are at the highest levels in 10 years. So it doesn't make any sense to just give everybody a gun, because law enforcement obviously is armed, and yet more law enforcement officers are dying as a result of the ability of these weapons to be out there, to be more prevalent again in society, to give access to these unstable individuals the high-capacity firepower that's only useful for mowing down people. You don't need 10 rounds or 20 rounds to shoot a deer. You don't need it for hunting. You don't need it for any sporting purpose, which is why, despite the expiration of the federal assault weapon ban, these guns still cannot be imported legally.
Brian, let me see how far you'd go on the other side here. I pressed Larry on a mentally ill person having access to a gun. In this case, you had church members having concealed weapons. Now, the woman that shot the killer, apparently, by the way, she didn't kill him. He did kill himself, the autopsy showed. But the woman that shot him was a former law enforcement officer. She was a volunteer security guard at that church. Do you have a problem with people like that owning guns?
The church essentially employed her to have a gun on the premise. They actually stepped up security after this shooter in Colorado had fired at the related facility.
The Arvada Youth Ministry.
Yeah, so, if they want to have a security where they're in control, they get to decide who it is that has a firearm on their premise, then they have some control of the security of that premise, and no, I don't have a problem with that. I think what we have a problem with is prohibiting, like employers, for example. There's a whole campaign now to force guns into the workplace, to prohibit employers from being able to bar guns by their employees in the workplace. That's a battle that's been going on now for a few years. Employers, I can guarantee you, almost universally have these kinds of policies to restrict guns on the premise, because that's the only way they can retain control over the security on their premise. But we don't have a problem with trained security guards having weapons, and if an employer, or in this case the church, feels threatened enough that they feel a need to have that kind of security, we don't have a problem with that.
Brian, let me turn the question to Robert Hawkins in Omaha. Now, he had a history of mental health problems. He was a ward of the state for 4 years. He threatened to kill his stepmother. He threatened to kill a 16-year-old girl and her family. He was diagnosed with a specific mental health disorder that made him extremely defiant. The family health care program, like a lot of health care in this country, ceased paying for him after a while. The state took care of him for a while. And then he wouldn't do certain things the state wanted him to do, so incredibly, they just let him walk free. are there laws on the books that would prevent someone like Robert Hawkins from owning a gun? Now, to be fair, he didn't seem to have purchased a gun. He seems to have stolen it from his stepfather. Are there laws to either prevent people like him from owning a gun, or, in the absence of that, laws to require the stepfather to lock up his gun so it's not so easy for a crazy killer like Robert Hawkins to get it?
Well, there are, and the latter point first, there are laws that hold gun owners responsible if a youth, you know, an underage person, you know, takes their gun and uses it in a crime.
Well, he was 19. He wasn't quite underage.
Well,
does that matter?
Yeah, I mean, I think we brought a lawsuit, actually, a successful lawsuit in Indiana, where the parents of a child much like this person basically had run-ins with the police, we had mentally unstable and so forth. You know, the parents were careful to secure their money from their son stealing it, but not their firearms. And their son came in, stole one of their guns, and ended up in a shootout with police in which a law enforcement officer, I believe, was killed or seriously injured. And we were successful in Indiana in holding the parents responsible in that situation. They should be responsible. Anyone, if they know that the person is unstable and they don't lock up their guns, they should be responsible.
What about buying a gun? Could Robert Hawkins, with his record, have walked into a gun store or a gun show and just bought an AK-47?
I mean, the two classifications in federal law, mental health disqualifications, if you will, they have to be either adjudicated mentally defective, which the shooter in Virginia Tech was, or they have to be involuntarily committed to a mental institution. Now, I don't know for sure whether he fit in those narrow categories. One of the problems, of course, with the system that came out after Virginia Tech is that even those two categories, which are fairly narrow, most states don't put the people who fit in those categories into the background check system, so that if they walk into a gun store and try to buy a firearm, and in this case, a 19-year-old could go into any gun store and buy a long gun, which this was, and walk out. They can't buy a handgun, but they could go in and buy a long gun. In any event, we found out after Virginia Tech that only about 10% of the mental health records of those two qualifications, the disqualifications I mentioned, are even in the system. So there's thousands and thousands of people who fit into these mental health categories who can go into gun stores and would pass a background check. And that certainly is a loophole that needs to be closed immediately. Now, there is a bill in Congress that's been held up in the Senate that would start to do that, would give the states more money to and the incentives to get these records into the system. And that bill certainly, it should have passed already. It definitely needs to pass. President Bush needs to sign it. I mean, it's even a bill that was supported by the NRA, so you can't argue, though maybe Mr. Pratt will, that it's a bill that overreaches in any respect.
Brian, I'd like to address one of Larry Pratt's arguments, and I've got to get back to him. I'm sure he has a lot to say on what you said. But one of the things he said is, look, if you have a law, even a law that bans mentally ill people, if you have a law that bans handguns entirely in D.C., of course, D.C. is surrounded by Virginia and Maryland, but even in England, a place, an island, that banned guns. Heck, even the police don't own guns in England. It doesn't prevent the bad people, the crazy people, from getting guns. It just prevents the good people from having guns, the same kind of good people that could stop a shooter if he goes on a rampage. How do you address that argument?
Well, for a couple ways. One, for 10 years after the Brady Law was passed and the assault weapon law was passed, crime came down. Every year it came down. 1.4 million people have been barred from buying a gun at a gun store because they failed the background check. And after that law passed, handgun crime, which was at its peak, came down every year for the next 10 years. Okay, so these laws, in fact, do work. They do save lives. Okay, I mentioned before, now we've seen the assault weapon ban expire in 2004. And lo and behold, we're now seeing a whole host of mass shootings with those very weapons that were illegal for 10 years.
So the weapon that Cho had and Hawkins had and Murray had, those weapons were banned for 10 years?
Cho had a pistol, but he had a number of high-capacity magazines that he put in that pistol that turned that ordinary pistol into a high-capacity killing machine. Okay, he put 32-round clips in there, allowed him to fire off a lot more bullets than he would have been able to if he'd only had 10-round magazines. And the same thing in Colorado, or the same thing certainly in the Omaha mall shooting.
Let me get
30
back.
Round clip, able to fire off a lot of bullets without reloading. And that, in addition, both the Colorado and the Omaha shooter were using assault weapons.
Let me get back to Larry Pratt here, who I know has a lot to respond to. Larry, specifically, I'd like you to address, among other things you want to respond to, Brian's argument about these high-capacity clips. I mean, a hunter doesn't need 32 rounds from an AK-47 to kill a deer, does he? Why? What is wrong with banning these high-capacity magazines?
Well, the problem is, other than the Constitution, you're banning people from using them in defensive use, and they have been used rather successfully in defensive use after hurricanes, after riots. Whenever the civil order has fallen apart, you find that people have to deal with not just individual home invaders, but whole gangs of toughs that are burning and looting. And the idea that we have a Archita Queensberry set of rules where the homeowner is limited to a five-shot revolver or some such quaint notion is extremely anti-victim and, again, empowering to the criminals and to the thugs.
But, Larry, let me ask you, these 32-round clips or these even 1,000 rounds, which Brian points out that some of the killers had, I mean, maybe 32 rounds, but 1,000 rounds? I mean, I can name a number of examples where killers brought 1,000 rounds.
He had them in a backpack.
Right, I understand. But why should a person in a household need 1,000 rounds? I mean, I can understand why a killer might want 1,000 rounds. Why would a victim need 1,000 rounds?
Well, anybody that is practicing with their firearm is going to use that kind of ammunition rather quickly. So that's probably a good question for somebody to ask that's not familiar with guns, but for those who are, that's really not a large amount of ammunition at all. I think it's important that
And these 32-round clips, what would they be used for? A victim defending his home or her home would need 32 rounds in one clip?
I think that would be a very good idea. I don't see any problem with that whatsoever.
Do you have any statistics on whether victims using these 32 rounds are more common or killers using these 32-round clips are more common?
Well, most self-defense gun uses in our country are not even reported. So we're going to have a little trouble presenting the data, just like nobody knows how many guns we do have in this country, because in most jurisdictions there's really no registration system for keeping track of who has what guns. So, no, we don't have data on that. We just know that clearly, that, for instance, the guard, the volunteers in the plural that were defending the church in Colorado had more than one magazine of, and probably fairly large magazine from what I can tell of the amount of bullets that were fired, because that obviously made sense in a defensive situation, and it enabled her to take down a guy with superior firepower with her handgun, which wasn't a powerful enough caliber to even actually kill him. It wounded him. It took him out of action, which was the immediate objective.
Let me ask you about the question of whether a gun owner should be held responsible, particularly a parent, if their child steals their firearms. In the case of Robert Hawkins in Omaha, Nebraska, it appears from all accounts that he stole his stepfather's AK-47. It doesn't say whether it was locked up or not. Let's assume it wasn't locked up. Should that man be held accountable for knowing that a person who's been, you know, a ward of the state and threatening people's lives lives in his home? Let's say, for the sake of argument, because I don't know the answer, that he did not leave his gun locked up. Should he be held criminally responsible for that?
I think this killer was quite of age, knew what he was doing. He should be responsible for the theft.
Not his stepfather, too, for allowing that gun to be taken?
No. I don't believe that we should be spreading the blame from the criminal to other people who themselves have been victimized by the criminal. That's not a good principle of law. You end up penalizing people who haven't been involved in a crime at all. I would like to address some of the things that were said about the semi-auto ban.
Yeah.
The New York State Police did a study run-up to the national ban, and they found that these firearms were used in fewer murders, fewer violent assaults than were people using hands and feet. And so there wasn't much of a crime problem with them beforehand.
Yeah, but Larry,
and
I mean...
Let me just finish. When this ban was in place, we didn't see any appreciable change whatsoever in their use in these crimes, although the guns were frozen. They weren't banned, so new ones weren't coming into people's possession of the ones described in the bill, but others just like them were being made, as well as the stock that had already been there. And still the violent crime rate
with these guns.
One other thing. The idea that somehow there was a drop off of the use of these guns in crime is something that comes from a very improper use of BATF, Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosive data for tracing guns. And it has been learned that they don't trace just guns that have been used in a crime and found with a perpetrator. They trace all kinds of guns for all kinds of reasons, and that skewered the data because there was more interest in IDing guns that were the semi-automatic kind. People were curious about them. People wanted to know, well, maybe they were used in a crime. And so there was a very large number of those traces, but these guns hadn't actually been picked up at the scene of a crime when used by a perpetrator.
Larry, let me ask you, when you say that violent assaults had gone up, I have no doubt that people with their hands and feet, commit more assaults than guns. I'm sure that, bar fights and kids in playgrounds.
No, murders.
People, you're talking about murders. Okay,
yes.
I just wanted to be clear. You're not just talking about somebody hitting someone, because
correct.
If you hit somebody, it's probably unlikely you're going to kill them. If you shoot someone with an AK-47, the chances of their dying, I think, are a bit more likely.
They were studying murders.
All right, let me give Brian a quick chance to respond to your statistics, and then I got to get our callers in because I know they're waiting. The number, by the way, folks, is 202-588-0893, 202-588-0893. If you're listening outside of D.C., on the Internet, if you're on the horn, the toll-free number is 888-488-MARK, 888-488-6275. I know you want to ask questions of both these gentlemen. Brian, answer Larry's point about statistics.
I've never said that assault weapons are the most frequently used guns in crime. Handguns are the most frequently used guns in crimes. But what the data shows is that at the time of the ban, or prior to the ban, assault weapons were used in about almost 6% of crimes, 6% of the crime guns that were recovered in America. And by the end of the ban, it was about 1%. So it was a huge decline from the before the ban to the end of the ban, showing that these weapons were slowly but surely falling out of circulation. And he's right that it didn't ban the guns that were in place before the ban took effect, which is why it took 10 years really for the impact of the ban to be felt more fully. But then we went and let that law lapse, and now suddenly we're seeing this new spike in the use of these guns in mass shootings. We're seeing law enforcement deaths going up because law enforcement often outgunned by a person who has an assault rifle with a high-capacity magazine. We learned our lesson. We should have learned our lesson that the doing background checks, getting rid of these killing machines, were good things. They actually saved a lot of lives. And instead, we're going to this new regime. We're putting those guns back in the street and leaving the loopholes in the law in terms of background checks. To us, that is not the way to go. And if we want to have a safer society, if we don't want to just throw up our hands, give everybody a gun, and start the crossfire, we really ought to go back to the things that were working in the 90s and return to that, because it really did make a difference.
Let's take a quick break, give people a chance to call in. The number is 202-588-0893, 202-588-0893, or you can call toll-free 888-488-MARK. That's 888-488-MARK, if you prefer numbers, 888-488-6275. We'll be right back with our guests, Larry Pratt, the Executive Director of Gun Owners of America, and Brian Seibel with the Brady Project to Prevent Handgun Violence. And when we come back with your calls, I'm also going to ask both these gentlemen about the Second Amendment and the case up on the D.C. gun ban before the United States Supreme Court. We'll be back right after this.
Greetings. We are Sweet Honey in the Rock, inviting you to join us in celebrating the 30th anniversary of WPFW 89.3 FM Pacifica on December the 15th at the Washington Convention Center.
On that date, we, along with performing artist Gloria Lynn and the Peace and Justice awardees, which includes Dick Gregory, Amy Goodman, Harry Belafonte, and others, will join you in this important evening that will launch the Building Fund campaign to purchase a permanent home for WPFW.
WPFW has enriched the lives of so many, and we look forward to both celebrating their achievements and strengthening their future. So a happy birthday to you, WPFW, Jazz and Justice Radio.
Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday.
From Washington, more of the Inside Scoop with Mark Levine.
Welcome back to the Inside Scoop, part of the Dialogue Series at Pacifica Radio 89.3. I'm your host, Mark Levine, bringing you all the news the government does not want you to know. And we're talking today about gun control, gun regulation in the wake of the shootings in Nebraska and Colorado. My guests are Larry Pratt, the executive director of the Gun Owners of America, and Brian Seibel with the Brady Campaign to Prevent Handgun Violence. Jim Brady, by the way, for whom the Brady Campaign is named after, was Ronald Reagan's press secretary. More than 25 years ago, he was shot in Washington by a mentally unstable individual, John Hinckley. It is for him that the campaign is named. The toll-free number is 888-488-MARK. The local number, 202-588-0893. Waldo, welcome to the Inside Scoop.
Hello, kid.
You're on the air, Waldo. What's your question?
Yeah. First of all, if you're talking about taking guns out of the hands of the criminals, there's a class that's running this society that has more guns, bombs, and planes, and weapons of mass destruction. If you, we should start there with taking the guns out. Second of all, I believe that that people do have the right to rationally defend themselves and to defend their homes. But also, my question to the Gun Owner of America, and I don't mean to be antagonistic, there also needs to be a way of anger management. Do you believe that gun owners should also look into anger management and ways of using a weapon as the last resort? And I'll take my question off the air.
Thank you, Waldo. He raises a number of good points. Let me start with you, Larry Pratt. Should gun owners have to undergo some kind of counseling or test, or anger management is what the words Waldo used, but some kind of test, I guess, to own a gun? After all, before we get to drive a car, which can also kill people but has other uses, we have to pass a driving test, and then our cars are registered. Why shouldn't something like that be required for gun owners? After all, guns do kill people.
Well, if we look at the rate of crime, violent crime committed by different groups in our society, we'd have to conclude that everybody else first ought to have anger management before gun owners, because gun owners are people who specifically have concealed carry permits are the ones who commit the fewest per capita amount of crime of any group, even police, whatever, ministers of the society. So I think the assumption that somehow people that have guns are angry people is not a good assumption.
But what's wrong with some kind of licensing procedure like we have for cars?
Well, why are you so insistent on singling out the gun owner and particularly the guy that's walking around on the street with a gun when he turns out to be your best guy?
Do you believe that cars should be registered and we should have to pass driver's tests before we drive, too?
Well, it hasn't done a whole lot to keep the death rate with cars even higher than it is from firearms, so I'm not sure I can see the utility in it. I think most people do these things because most people have common sense, and they don't need the government to be telling them to do something that's pretty obvious. Whether people want to drive a car, whether they want to own a gun, their first instinct is, how do I do it?
Brian, what's your response?
Well, a couple things. One of the things, I think his idea that the concealed carry licensees are the safest people in America is just false. There's been quite a lot of crimes committed by people with concealed carry licenses. And I think the telling thing is that the Larry's group and the NRA want to actually conceal from the public the criminal records of those people who have CCW licenses. They want to prevent states that have these liberalized concealed carry laws from actually tracking the rate at which concealed carry licenses commit crimes. I know there was one study done a few years ago about Texas that showed, you know, quite a lot of crimes, you know, hundreds, if not thousands, of crimes by concealed carry licensees. They're not necessarily upstanding citizens, though some of them certainly are. I have no doubt of that. And I guess in response to the caller, I would say that, you know, we don't advocate against people, you know, not being able to have a firearm in the home for self-defense if they choose to.
But doesn't that what the D.C., the District of Columbia law does? Doesn't it prevent people from having firearms
in the home? Well, it prevents them from having handguns. It does not prevent them from having long guns or rifles. But our point about the D.C. case is that it's all about the Second Amendment, that the Second Amendment was interpreted, 70 years ago in the Supreme Court in a unanimous decision, United States versus Miller, that said you have to read it with its militia purpose in mind, and you can't divorce it from that militia purpose. And so the result of that is that gun laws are decided in the democratic sphere, the political sphere, by legislatures across America. That's really how it should be. These questions, these debates we're having, should be had, but they should be decided not by courts, but by people voting and the elected officials making decisions about whether particular gun laws are going to save lives or not.
Larry Pratt, the Second Amendment reads, and I'm going to quote it in full, it's not a very long amendment, quote, "A well-regulated militia, being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed." It's the only one of the amendments in the Bill of Rights to actually give a reason for its purpose. It just says in the First Amendment, Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise or abridging freedom of speech. It doesn't seek to qualify it in any way. The Second Amendment does talk about this militia, and as I'm sure you know, for 216 years since it was written, the Supreme Court has held that it does protect the right of people to join a militia, to use these state militias to protect against overweening federal influence, but it has never been held, and it could change this year, but until this year, it has never been held that protects an individual's right to bear arms. Why should this 216-year-old traditional interpretation of the Second Amendment, why should that change in your view?
It's not really the traditional interpretation. A lot of state constitutions that are quite consistent with the historical and the framers' view of what that Second Amendment was designed to do. It was very reflective of the Militia Act of 1792, which was passed on the heels of the final ratification of the Bill of Rights. And in that act, it basically reiterated what had been colonial law throughout all of the colonies, without exception, that all free men had to have a gun, had to have a military gun, they had to have the ammunition for it, and it had to be in working order. And the colonial militia was one where it was mandatory, like that Militia Act of 1792, and you'd be fined if you didn't come to muster. You'd be fined if you didn't come with your musket or your rifle to be used for military purposes, and you would be fined if it wasn't in working order. So it clearly was something that relied upon the individual citizenry with their own firearms. And the other word that I think has been seized upon to cause so much confusion, not the word itself, but the surrounding discussion in the last probably quarter of a century or so, is the word state. And as Judge Silberman pointed out in his brief for the D.C. Court of Appeals, which overturned the D.C. gun ban, he said, look, the word state there is an 18th century word, and it doesn't mean the concept that we have in mind now. When we say the state, we think of New York, we think of North Carolina, whatever. But at the time, that word primarily meant a free society. So this militia is to protect a free society. By the way, its secondary meaning was nation state. And it's, I think, kind of important to remember that when King George III signed off on the end of the war for of independence. He didn't sign a treaty with the United States. He signed 13 different treaties with 13 independent nation states. So we need to keep that in mind, that this is the idea that somehow this is a National Guard kind of militia only. Well, for one thing, National Guard didn't exist for over 100 years, and secondly, it's totally out of sorts with the idea of the armed citizenry comprising that militia to protect a free society.
I have to tell you, Larry, I don't find Judge Silberman's argument about the word state very persuasive.
I'm not surprised that you don't.
Well, throughout the Constitution...
Can I jump in, Mark?
You can. I'll give you a second, Brian, but just want to say, throughout the Constitution, there is the word state. It is capitalized, and in every other instance in the Constitution, including when it labels which state should have how many representatives in the House of Representatives, it's very clear that capital S state is referring to each of the 50 United States.
Well,
so that particular
Mark,
argument, I don't find very persuasive.
When the Supremes spoke in 91 about the term the people throughout the Bill of Rights, and it is used several times, including in the Second Amendment, they found that it always referred to individuals. And I'm sure they may have that in mind as well,
okay,
as they consider the case that's coming up from the D.C. Court of Appeals.
I know that Brian wanted to respond. Go ahead.
Well, I mean, the real question is to keep and bear arms for what? For what purpose? I mean, the military today gets a weapon. That doesn't give them the right to go home with it and use it for their own purposes, their own private purposes. Yes, the militia of the day was the citizenry, and they were required under the Militia Act of 1792 to buy a gun and bring it with them to muster. But that's the role in which the gun played, and in fact, they didn't really own that weapon. Because under the Militia Act of 1792, they couldn't use it, they couldn't sell it, they couldn't use it to pay debts or taxes. It was actually a weapon that was designed to be used in militia service.
So it was more like a draft. At that time, everyone had to be drafted and serve and protect the nation, which is different from today. Is that what you're saying, Brian?
Yeah, no, the militia was a broad-based institution, absolutely, at the time. And people brought guns that they were required to buy to the militia muster. But the Second Amendment doesn't protect the right to then take that gun and go off and do your own thing with it.
The author of the Second Amendment, James Madison, I've read an earlier draft of the amendment, and the earlier draft talks about the militia being composed of the free body of the people, which does seem to suggest that he did expect everyone to keep their gun
actually,
and be
that,
part of it.
That language was struck. Composed of the body of the people was actually struck.
Right.
And
why was that struck? Any idea, Brian?
Well, because the militia clause of Article 1, Section 8, essentially give Congress the authority to define the militia. Okay? So under the Dick Act of 1903, after we'd gone a century of this volunteer, this militia of everyone, not really working, it wasn't long. It was by 1809. I mean, even 15, 20 years after the Militia Act, people really weren't buying guns and bringing them to militia service. The whole thing kind of broke down and was of intermittent value over the next 100 years. And by 1903, Teddy Roosevelt said the militia is a dead letter, it's useless. So they passed the Dick Act and they created the National Guard. They essentially created a much more effective militia that had a real source of arms. I mean, even in the beginning, people didn't buy the guns. They'd ask the state to buy them or the federal government to buy them. And, it worked better in the northeastern states, worse in the southern states.
Let me read
just
briefly
from state to state.
From Article 1, Section 8. I always like to – I carry my Constitution with me every show I do because I think people need to know what's in it. Article 1, Section 8 gives Congress the power to provide for calling forth the militia to execute the laws of the Union, suppress insurrections, and repel invasions. It also gives Congress the right to provide for organizing, arming, and disciplining the militia, and for governing such part of them as may be employed in the service of the United States. The states are reserved the right to appoint the officers and to train the militia according to the discipline prescribed by Congress. Larry, do you have a brief comment? I want to get some more callers.
Well, the idea that they weren't at liberty to use their guns and that the government was primarily the source for buying the guns sounds kind of like the discredited thesis of Michael Belial. That would have been very surprising to the founders to hear something like that, because that's simply not the way America was working.
Let me get to RG. He's been hanging on a long time. He or she, I don't know. Excuse me. I just to have your initials there, RG. Welcome to the dialogue, Inside Scoop.
I'm a big he.
Okay.
Right?
Welcome. Welcome.
Nothing more that I like watching than if I could find a 1959 rerun of The Deputy with Henry Fonda, you know. And, of course, we all know about Gunsmoke. That runs rather regularly now, but I'm into sort of the more obscure TV programs from that era. To your guest, I think the Old West mantra that I hear emanating from the side of the guy that's with
Larry
the
Pratt.
Gun Owners of America, I think that his group may be just slightly valenced or skewed toward the NRA position.
No, no question.
Too much about the NRA.
Well, what's your question to the guests?
Well, I'd like to know what flies and what doesn't. I mean, to use constitutional law as a benchmark here, I find rather, you know, pointless because of the fact that, you know, the touchstone here should be to try to achieve keeping the public peace. I mean, who's the good guy and who's the bad guy compared to what? I mean, you know, if a guy's out to perpetrate a melee or a subterfuge of some kind against society, then, you know, we have to try to do something about it. But to try to use constitutional law in this setting, in a setting of homeland security, when every other constitutional precept is being a subverted, I really don't think that'll fly as a solution here.
Well, let me ask you what your solution is. I mean, obviously, the Constitution is just a limit. The states can do different things. D.C. has a handgun ban on people in their homes. You know, in Nebraska and in Colorado, there's very few, or much fewer gun restrictions. And then, of course, the Constitution is an ultimate limit. And whether it says that you can only use a gun to serve in a militia is one interpretation. The other interpretation is that an individual can have pretty much any firearms they want.
Okay,
what's
in
your
some
position?
Circles, Constitution is not a limit. It's actually a pathway, an open a door to another level of exercising the freedom, as opposed to actually being a limit.
Well,
it depends
no
on
question. Other instances. Just to make that. Do you have a specific question for our guest?
Yeah. Okay. Well, I'll just say this. I think that there's a conflict of laws, basically, between the constitutional law, what you use in your colloquy, connotation of the term state. I mean, we know. I think by now we pretty much know what you know. Like in the title, enemy of the state. How do you see using the existing legal structure outside of law enforcement and the you know utilization of dealing with folks with guns on a case by case basis, we see that going on in the District of Columbia now, with, hand in hand with gentrification. Okay, so that's my question.
Okay, do you support the DC gun ban, RG, or not? Or not?
I don't like guns at all per se, but. No, I don't know if I do or not. I guess I don't, because, I mean, you know, everybody should have that right. But as to determine who's the good or bad guy, it's right down to the second the situation erupts. I don't agree with curtailing human or civil rights in any way.
Okay, thanks for your call. Right. I appreciate it. Let me just ask Brian, does it curtail people's civil rights to ban handguns in the homes in D.C.?
Well, obviously it's a restriction on their ability to have a firearm in the home. But, you know, the D.C., did it to save lives. I mean, D.C. has the lowest suicide rate in the nation, which is, you know, no insignificant fact. I mean, if you compared, say, a western state like Wyoming, or, you know, with a comparable number of people, it's close to 90 to 100 people commit suicide with firearms every year in that state. There's 5 that commit suicide with a firearm in the District of Columbia. So right there you're saving potentially almost 100 lives a year just on the suicide issue. I mean, a gun in the home is far more likely to be used in a suicide. It's actually 11 times used in a suicide to every time it's used against an intruder. So a gun in the home really is not something that improves the security of a home. In fact, it actually increases the danger to people within the home.
How about that, Larry? Wyoming and D.C. have approximately the same population. In fact, there's a few more people in D.C., and yet Brian cites statistics to say that 90 to 100 people commit suicide with firearms in Wyoming to about 5 in D.C., which we all know there's all kinds of problems in the District of Columbia, and yet the suicide rate is so much lower with firearms. How do you explain that?
Well, I think maybe Brian has just choked over a gnat and swallowed a camel. In fact, D.C. has typically, in any given year, the highest murder rate of any jurisdiction. So whether you're dying from whatever it may be, whether you're committing suicide with a gun or with some poison, whether you're murdering somebody in whatever fashion, D.C. is a rough place to live, and that's the place with the gun ban. And even the long guns are not available for self-defense. They have to be kept in such a way that you might as well not own it.
You certainly would
not be able to have it available for self-defense, and the city authorities, that's the way they want it. Now, if you go right across the river to a place like Fairfax, Virginia, which is an urban county, double the population just about of the District of Columbia, you find 1/100th of the murder rate, a place where guns are readily available, where people can have concealed carry permits. It seems to me there's a lot of questions that get begged by pointing to D.C.'s highly successful lowering of the suicide rate with guns, when in fact it's a bloody place to be.
Brian, I can hear you chomping at the bit. Go ahead.
I mean, you know, compare apples and apples, frankly. I mean, you know, we always like to hear this thing about D.C. having the highest rate. Well, it's the only solely urban state in the nation. I mean, it's not actually a state. It's a district.
So
but
urbanization
essentially, it should be compared
crime.
To Detroit. It should be compared to other Baltimore. I mean, Baltimore, for example, it should be compared to other purely urban environments. And in that sense, it actually doesn't have the highest rate. But the problem with the D.C. handgun ban is that it's easily circumvented by people going into Virginia and Maryland and other states and buying guns up and bringing them across state lines. And,
but the guns are in Virginia that don't cause a problem. How do you explain that?
Fairfax County is not the, you know, is not the same environment. And
so environment causes crime?
I think in urban America we're seeing an explosion.
So we should ban environment, not ban guns?
No. What I'm saying is in urban America we've been seeing an explosion in growth of firearms crime in the last 2 or 3 years, okay? And it's after we let the assault weapon ban expire. It's after we crack down on law enforcement sharing of crime gun trace information. It's after we gave the Congress attempted to give broad protection to the gun industry from lawsuits. And it's after we essentially took the cops off the street through the COPS program that the Clinton administration had advanced. So it's after we took all these steps to reduce our ability to track down on gun crime that suddenly crime is going up. Not just in the District of Columbia, which actually until this year it had not gone up, but across America, okay, where guns are not nearly as restricted as they are in the District of Columbia.
I think we need to look
at this on a national basis and realize that there were laws that were very effective, the assault weapon ban being one of them.
Let me just jump in on that.
Okay, real quick, because I want to get to our callers.
Those 93-94 bans, the Brady Law, they came after... And a couple of years after, crime had already started to decline.
No, that's not true.
The criminals must have been extremely prescient to have seen what was going to happen and have begun already laying off their crime-prone tendencies.
I mean, it
fell all through.
It doesn't take a rocket scientist to realize that if you stop 1.4 million illegal buyers from buying a gun at a gun store, that it's going to have a beneficial effect.
No,
okay?
No,
I think even the NRA would agree that we should have background checks. And that we should prevent people who are prohibited from owning guns from buying guns. The problem is we only check them at gun stores. We don't check them when they're making a private sale at a gun show or another place.
You know,
so,
you're not buying or selling guns at all in England, and yet that hasn't stopped their crime problem. Au contraire, the UN found about 5 years ago that their violent crime rate has soared beyond all of the other industrial countries that they were studying. It's been an abject
failure.
And there
are fewer gun murders in England than there are in basically any city of America.
But it's on the way up,
okay?
Very
fewer
sharply.
Than any city
in fact,
in America.
The government is under attack by people in the media for having fudged on the numbers.
Okay,
there'll
guys.
Be things like reporting a crime as a robbery, because that was the underlying crime, even though maybe two people were murdered subsequently in the robbery.
I want to interrupt
you
both just
for a second. The Europeans would be appalled by what happens in Omaha and what happened in Colorado.
But it happened in Europe as well with their gun laws.
It
happened there, too. Happened in Switzerland, happened in France, happened in Finland, happened in Germany, happened in Canada.
Every week.
I tell you what, guys, I need to separate you both for just a second, because we do have a couple callers calling in, and there's only about 6 minutes left. So let me just quickly get to GR. We go from RG to GR. A woman, welcome to the Inside Scoop. Welcome to Dialogue. You're on the air, GR. Go ahead.
Thank you. I'm going to refer again, you probably have, to the CDC 1994 study on gun-related deaths internationally, and which found that the United States has the highest number, five or six times more than in Europe or Australia or New Zealand, of all the 36 richest countries in the world. And how is it that you can read history and read the Constitution and extrapolate or otherwise guess, where you cannot know the specific intent of the founding fathers with regard to gun ownership? Do you think that their intent was to see a result of the United States having the highest number of gun-related deaths in the world? In Japan, where there are few guns owned, there's less than 1% of gun-related deaths. In the United States, it's many, many more.
Thank you for your call, GR. I want to address that quickly to Larry Pratt. Larry, I mean, the point is that she's making, it's the same point that Brian was making, is that for all the increase in gun-related deaths in England, still you have an entire country of 60 million people, and they have less gun deaths than any major American metropolis. I mean, our rate is, what, 10, 20, I don't even know, 30 times that of European countries per capita?
It is not quite twice. In fact, the CDC and the National Academy of Science subsequently have done studies, meta-studies of all the gun studies that have been done throughout the years, and they found that when you take a look at what actually has been found, gun control has had no discernible effect in their view. I would say it's had a negative effect, but anyway, the same CDC that was just referred to did go on to find years later that these gun control laws have not been effective in curtailing crime. So it gets back to the point I was making. We've got to stop empowering criminals by taking away the means for their victims to defend themselves. That is cruel and unusual punishment.
Brian, is it just twice, or is it?
Here's our God Bless America poster, which in 2004, guns murdered 5 people in New Zealand, 37 in Sweden, 56 in Australia, 73 in England and Wales, 184 in Canada, and 11,344 in the United States.
So that's 100 times.
No, you didn't put Switzerland
times.
In that list, and that's an interesting omission because they are more heavily armed than we are here. They still keep their military weapons at home, and yet they have one of the lowest murder rates of any country in the world.
And yet that's 100 times. It's not exactly twice. Let me go very quickly to Chris. You're our last caller. Chris, make your point quick, please.
Actually, I'm going to bounce off right off of that fact. Switzerland, okay, has more guns or per population, which points to why are we seeing so many people die here in the States. And you got to look at poverty as a huge factor. If we eliminate poverty in this country, which we can do instead of spending all this money in Iraq, we can put it to the poor folks here, you better believe violent crime by gun will diminish tremendously.
Thank you
and
for
it's
your
not,
point, Chris.
You know, historically, we know that that was not the case. During the Great Depression, crime actually fell all through that period.
Brian, let me ask you, one, about Switzerland, and two, about crime and poverty, the relation.
I mean, certainly we should eradicate poverty. And, you know, I'm not professing to be an expert on the relationship between the two, but my point has been that when we have done the right things about guns, doing background checks, we should do more thoroughly, banning assault weapons, crime came down in this country 10 years in a row, okay? When we stopped doing those things, when we let the assault weapon ban expire, lo and behold, we're now seeing these mass shootings with these assault weapons, with these high-capacity magazines, not only at Virginia Tech, but in Omaha, in Colorado, I could go on and on.
Do you have a 20-second comment on Switzerland in that example?
Well, again, you know, Switzerland's reevaluating that, but I think, you know, it's a different tradition in Switzerland and than we've seen in this country. And in this country, you know, we've got this access to handguns in the hands of unstable people, and we need to do more to prevent that.
I should just note, I actually lived in Switzerland for a year, and it's true that everyone there is required to own a gun, much in the way of the Second Amendment of the militias, but they were these long rifles with one shot that they had to keep clean, that they would check every day, that everyone had locked up in their closets.
Guns that I saw, Mark. When I was over there, those were machine guns.
Okay, so you talked to a different Swiss person than I did, and
that's
certainly possible.
I went to their national competition where people from all over the country were bringing these weapons, and they were not single shot.
That's going to have to be the last word. I want to thank very much Larry Pratt, the Executive Director of Concerned Gun Owners of America, and also Brian Seibel. He's with the Legal Action Project for the Brady Campaign to Prevent Handgun Violence. I also want to make sure everyone knows that WPFW is celebrating its 30th anniversary this Saturday, December 15th, at the D.C. Convention Center. You can get tickets on the Internet. You can also call the WPFW office at 202-588-0999, extension 344. And if you want, you can ask to sit at my table. I'd love to meet each every one of you and give all of you the inside scoop. For more on the inside scoop, check out the Head On Radio Network or radioinsidescoop.com, www.radioinsidescoop.com. This is Mark Levine signing off.
This is the Quality News Network. British Prime Minister Gordon Brown says that Allied forces are winning the battle against insurgents in Afghanistan. Brown also maintains that no negotiations will be held with Taliban leaders, that they will be, quote, isolated and eliminated instead. Britain is also adding an additional £450 million for military equipment and development. That's equivalent to nearly $1 billion U.S. dollars. Former CIA directors George Tenet and Porter Goss will testify in a congressional probe focused on destruction of interrogation videotapes of terror suspects. The two men have become key figures in an expanding investigation into the possible cover-up of harsh interrogation techniques described by some as torture. Meanwhile, current CIA director Michael Hayden says he had limited knowledge in the matter, but that his agency could have done a much better job in keeping Congress informed about how the tapes were handled. The first formal peace talks between Israelis and Palestinians in 7 years began today, but reportedly did not go well. The two sides traded barbs and accusations in today's...